Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, or how all through history God has been working out his plan to get us all to heaven or to save us all. We're talking about the Old Testament, the story of the creation, fall, and the beginning of the redemption of humankind. Our guest today, as usual, is from John Paul II Catholic High, Ron Eldred, who teaches history and religion at John Paul II Catholic High. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, the chaplain down at the Carmelites, just south of Terre Haute. Ron, we were talking the last time particularly about the plagues in Egypt, and we discussed that the 10 plagues for Pharaoh not letting the Israelites go. So we looked at some hypotheses offered by various scholars claiming that the miracles could be explained by ordinary natural disasters and not necessarily supernatural miracles. Now, even though each plague could be scientifically explained as a natural event, I think we really ought to try to make it clear that God was the ultimate cause if they just were natural events. God was the ultimate cause of each event. So could you say a word about that just to kind of tie on to what we had last week?
Certainly, that's a good point. Although each of the 10 plagues might be explained as a result of a natural event that occurred in Egypt at some time or another, probably over a period of 50 years or so, I said twice during that session that it is not likely that all of them would have occurred in a relatively short period of time, you know, a period maybe a few months, and in direct response to Moses' command, unless God had orchestrated the entire series of events. Moreover, God, as we discussed in that session, he ordinarily works through natural processes to accomplish his will. For example, God has performed countless instant medical cures over the ages through the intercession of the saints. But ordinarily, he heals people who employ the techniques of medical science, such as by the use of medicine or surgery or some other such technique. Nonetheless, the ultimate healer is God, just as he was the ultimate cause of the 10 plagues in ancient Egypt. I didn't get the impression from viewing the various programs on the documentary channels on the mysteries of the Bible that they were trying to prove that God didn't cause the 10 plagues or many of the other miracles described in the Old Testament, but they were simply trying to offer scientific explanations for their occurrence. In fact, after we recorded the last session, I saw a couple of programs on History Channel and History International, one about the Ten Commandments and another one that dealt specifically with the plagues and the Exodus and that kind of thing. And it was very similar to what we had discussed in that session. The problem with these programs, though, as I see it, is that the uninitiated viewer, which that's of course most viewers because they don't have the knowledge in anthropology or archaeology or history or about the history of the Bible and things of that sort. So the problem, as I said, is that people tend to interpret these programs or these plagues or any other miracle they're describing in these programs in a naturalistic way for those extraordinary events described in the Bible. In other words, they could draw the conclusion from the programs that the events described could have been simply natural events that don't need God's intervention to explain their causes. However, to repeat what I said, it is not likely that the 10 plagues could have occurred in a relatively short period of time and in direct response to Moses' command unless God had orchestrated the entire series of events himself. Whether or not they can be explained scientifically or not, I mean, I think that's kind of beside the point. And even to put it another way, God caused the 10 plagues to happen when they did occur.
Okay, If we can sort of piggyback on that, Ron, another issue that keeps constantly coming up was is the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah for their sins. Is there anything else you'd like to say about that story?
Yes, we discussed that story the time before last, if I recall right, before we discussed the 10 plagues. And I said at the time that certain persons over the centuries have claimed that the Sodomites, and that includes the people in all those cities, and there were a number of these cities. I read some estimates of 5. I read other estimates as many as 12 cities in that area around the Dead Sea. But these cities, several of the cities, were destroyed because of their homosexuality. The gay and the lesbian movement during the past several decades has arisen to challenge this interpretation. They claim that the cities were destroyed not for homosexuality, but for the lack of hospitality. And we discussed that point a little bit. I think that the context of the story that describes how certain Sodomites demanded that Lot turn over the two visiting men, which unknown to them are angels, so they could, quote, know them better, has a homosexual connotation. In other words, the word know, I have that in, you want to put that in quotations, the word know is used in the Bible several places to describe sexual relations. In fact, if I recall right, about something like 15 times or so in the Old Testament. I believe that most biblical scholars interpret know here as meaning homosexual acts, and not simply meaning to become better acquainted with the men. The verse that there has been so much controversy over is Genesis 19:5, which says, quote, "And they called to Lot, where are the men who came to you tonight?" These are these angels you see are standing with them there in the form of men. "Bring them out to us, that we may know them." End of quote. One source says that the word know appears over 900 times in the Old Testament, and about 1%, or only 13-14 times, does the word have a sexual meaning. Yet the other 99% usually means to question someone, especially strangers, about something. Other biblical scholars have countered this interpretation by pointing out that one of the examples of meaning to know sexually occurs only three verses later in the same narrative, which states, quote, and this is in Genesis 19:8, "Behold, I have two daughters who have not known man." There's the word know. "Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof." End of quote. My opinion is that the inhabitants of these cities were evil people who were guilty of all kinds of serious sins, and not just homosexuality, and that God destroyed them because he couldn't find even 10 just men in these cities.
Okay, well, I thank you for that, Ron. I think that keeps coming up frequently. I hear it even sometimes from Catholic commentators that it's really not homosexuality, but it's inhospitality for which the cities were destroyed. Okay, we got up, I think, to the Exodus, that great event in the life of the Hebrew people that has continually been reenacted down through the centuries. So how about describing the Exodus from Egypt, or the going out from Egypt?
Well, after God had inflicted 10 plagues on the Egyptians, and the 10th plague, of course, was the dreaded Passover of the Angel of Death, which even took the life of Pharaoh's son, he's going to let them go. The Israelites had assembled in groups to eat the Passover, or Paschal meal, of roasted lamb and unleavened bread the night before. And we're ready to go at daybreak in the very next morning, quite early. Pharaoh was so devastated at the loss of Egyptian lives, especially his son, that he let them go. the Egyptian peoples were so happy to see them go that they loaded them down with gifts of gold and silver and other gifts. Moses led the people hastily east to the Reed Sea, just north of the Red Sea, rather than north to the Mediterranean Sea. In other words, the Mediterranean Sea was the normal process, the normal route. North to the Mediterranean Sea, because he knew that Pharaoh would have a change of heart and pursue them with his army. Along the Mediterranean was the normal route, the closest route between Egypt and Palestine, or Canaan, the land of Canaan. The Reed Sea was more of a marsh than a large body of water, and Pharaoh and his nobles suddenly realized that they were losing their cheap labor. And when the people saw Pharaoh and his army approaching on their chariots, trying to catch them and make them come back, they became afraid and turned against Moses, as they were due to do on many times over the next 40 years. In anger, the Israelites said to Moses, quote, "Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? It is not what we said to you in Egypt. Let us alone and let us serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." This is quoted from Exodus 14, 10 through 12. As the Egyptians approached the Israelites in their chariots, God instructed Moses to lift up his rod and stretch his hand out over the sea. And as a result, a strong east wind blew all night, pushing the waters of the Reed Sea aside, which allowed the Israelites to pass safely over to the other side to dry land. And while this is going on, the Egyptians were held back long enough for the Israelites to cross the sea by a pillar of smoke. But when all of them and their animals had passed safely across, the Egyptians attempted to follow them. But God told Moses to stretch out his rod again, and the waters came crashing back down, drowning Pharaoh's army. Scott Hahn says of this event, quote, "Then without raising a sword, Israel had defeated Egypt, the mightiest empire in the world. God himself had won the victory. It was a kind of baptism through the waters of the Red Sea. God had saved the people of Israel from certain death." End of quote. Some scholars and scientists over the years have tried to explain away the parting of the waters in naturalistic terms, just as they did the 10 plagues, and I won't go into those, but as we said in regard to the 10 plagues, God usually performs his miracles through natural processes. The miracle is the fact that the parting of the sea took place at a specific time at Moses' command. Whether or not God used a natural process to accomplish this event, I think, is beside the point.
Okay. So it's a good reference that you were talking earlier when we began the program about God possibly using just natural causes, volcanoes, polluting, turning the river.
Earthquakes, all kinds of
earthquakes,
yes.
And solar eclipses and such things. But that it was at the time in the specific way that God was using to protect his people. Okay, it must have been a formidable job, Ron, to get the Israelites across the Reed Sea, but they had something like, 600,000 men, plus the children and women and animals?
Historians and biblical scholars have debated this issue for centuries. Exodus 12 refers to 600,000 adult Israelite men leaving Egypt with Moses, plus an apparently large number of women, children, and animals. Probably there were many non-Israelites that went along with them as well. In fact, Numbers 146 gives an exact total of 603,550 men. These numbers, if taken literally, are fantastic exaggerations. Exaggeration was commonly used in the ancient world to make a point. Sort of like Mom saying, I've told you a million times not to do that. We know that she's exaggerating to make her point, that she has told us a lot of times not to do that. If we take the numbers given in the Bible literally, this would mean that the total number of humans would have been at least 2 million. To this would have been added at least another million sheep, goats, and cattle. Well, at the time, the entire Egyptian population has been estimated to be between 3 and 6 million. So it isn't likely that the Israelites would have been half that number, or at least half that number. One scholar has calculated that 2.5 million people marching 10 abreast would form a line 150 miles long without taking into account livestock. In other words, the distance between Egypt, where they left the land of Goshen, to Canaan is just, 200 or 300 miles. You can't imagine, a whole string of people almost all the way from Egypt, all the way to halfway at least, to the land of Canaan. Another scholar has said that historians and archaeologists have found no evidence that the Egyptian economy at the time ever suffered such a huge loss. And there's no archaeological research that has found evidence that the Sinai Desert ever hosted or could have hosted millions of people, nor of a massive population increase in Cana, estimated to have had a population of no more than 50 to 100,000 people at the time.
Okay, I like your example, Mom, saying I told you a million times not to do it. It's a way of expressing a large number, and that fits into our understanding of the perhaps hyperbole that is used about the numbers. What seems to be a reasonable estimate of the number of Israelites who came out of Egypt under Moses' leadership?
Estimates have been numerous. I think that it is reasonable to conclude that the largest total number of Israelites possible would have been around 100,000, with as many animals. On the lower end, though, a Hebrew University professor by the name of Abraham Malamot has proposed that since it is believed that the entire Egyptian army at the time consisted of about 20,000 men, the Israelite army could not have been much larger than 5,000 to 6,000 men. And he extrapolates from that that the total Hebrew population could not have been more than 20,000. I think that's probably a little low estimate, it certainly was. You're keeping in mind now, you go back to about, let's say, 1700, 1650, something like that, when Jacob goes down with his family into Egypt. And I believe it says there was like 70, if I recall right, in the family at that time. And so this family, over 400 years, how much could it multiply? I wouldn't think that anything like 2.5 million or 2 million would be possible. I think probably I would kind of stick to the 100,000 or somewhere in that range.
Okay.
Well, let me make another comment. Most scholars believe that the Pentateuch didn't take its final shape. The Pentateuch, of course, you might recall, was the Greek translation of the first five books of the Old Testament. And it didn't take shape until centuries after the events described therein, and that the editors simply greatly exaggerated the details of the story to try to make a point in their own age, their own time. Nevertheless, the awesomeness of the event is not lessened, even if the numbers were much less and the passage was made at the very northern edge of the sea, that is, the Reed Sea, which was more of a marsh than a deep body of water. It would have taken many hours for the crossing to have been made, even with 100,000, let alone, with millions of people and animals. So the pictures that we see depicting the passage of the Israelites passing through the two high walls of water in the middle of the Red Sea is not likely what happened. In fact, the Bible doesn't even describe it that way. Talks about the wind, blowing the water over and what have you, an east wind. I think that we have to keep in mind what we said earlier in this series on the Bible, and two others on the Bible, that the Bible isn't intended to be a scientific textbook or an exact historical record of the past. As St. Augustine said in the late 4th century, and Cardinal Baronius repeated in the 16th, the Bible teaches us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. So it's not an historical textbook or a scientific textbook or anything of that sort. But there is, as we've said before, a lot of historical truth in the Bible as well.
Now I can imagine some of our listeners being concerned about what's being said, Ron, because it seems to say, well, I can't really believe what the Bible is saying. And aren't we trying to say that we're trying to understand what the Bible means, not just what it says? And so we use archaeology, we use historical records, we use other means of trying to see what historically, if hyperbole is being used, or they're trying to be literally factual and things like that. So we're trying to use the revelation of the Bible and put our reason to work at how this all fits together and how we understand it or interpret it.
Well, in the early centuries of the church, they were already beginning to be confronted with problems like this. There were pagan scholars who were making ridicule on the Bible because of seeming inconsistencies, contradictions, and things of this sort. And St. Augustine, Origen had dealt with this, and so had others before Augustine, but Augustine really hit the whole issue head on. And he points out that if the Bible seemed to have a contradiction or some inconsistencies in it, or things that it seemed to be absurd or don't make any sense or anything like that, so there must be a deeper spiritual meaning underlying this. And so he made some stab at that kind of thing, of course, in his own biblical scholarship and his writings. And so, as we said a while ago, he was the one that, in other words, a deeper spiritual meaning.
Okay.
And there's the literal meaning, and sometimes the Bible's intended to be taken literally. But sometimes, if you take it literally, then there's contradictions, and there's inconsistencies, and there's things that, the exaggerations that we were talking about, things that just simply couldn't be. Augustine is arguing that there must be some deeper spiritual meaning, and so we got to dig that out. And only the church really has the ability to do that. Only the church is protected by the Holy Spirit in the process of doing these kinds of interpretations.
So the church appreciates biblical study.
Sure.
As long as it doesn't get into the conclusion, well, that God is not really involved in this.
If you look at the church fathers, especially the apostolic fathers and the early patristic fathers, up to about the 5th century, they do a lot of biblical interpretation. And quite frankly, there's some of these biblical interpretations that are fantastic. But the church generally, the way the church, as I understand it, has decided which of these interpretations are correct is if the fathers were unanimous. If you find all the great, or many of the great church fathers interpreting a particular passage or a particular verse or passing on a certain doctrine of the church or something of that sort, if they're all in full agreement on that, then that becomes what the church accepts as the proper interpretation.
I know, for instance, when I was first heard in seminary that possibly there was a natural occurrence of the wind blowing the sea so to make dry land, and then according to the weather prophets of those days, it often came flowing back again. Gee, it almost startled my faith. I can't believe what the Bible is saying. So I had to learn to grow and to know that it's not just what the Bible says, it's what the Bible means.
But the point is that maybe that was a natural occurrence, but it's when it happened and under what command it happened. And as we said, God uses natural processes, but this was a miraculous in the sense that it happened at a certain time under certain circumstances. As Pharaoh and his army of 10,000 men on chariots are approaching to, you know, either kill them or to bring them back.
Well, and as you said earlier about Sodom and Gomorrah, there's a good explanation is that it was volcanic eruptions that buried the cities in fire and brimstone. But when it says God buried the city, rained down fire and brimstone, it means that God was using a natural phenomena to accomplish his will.
Or it could be an asteroid or something of that sort.
Yeah. I mean, it could have been anything. But it doesn't just have to mean that suddenly something happened, like an earthquake can happen, and we say, gee, it swallowed up a whole city of evil towns. So we don't necessarily disconnect the two.
I think what really matters is God behind it, and not exactly how, you know, that it happened.
Yeah. And a natural explanation is as good as anything else. Well, we're going to come up to what most people are pretty familiar with in some ways about Mount Sinai and the Ten Commandments. And I suppose we're going to have some explanations here trying to say, well, exactly how do we think this happened? We know that God gave the Ten Commandments to Moses on Mount Sinai and the like. So I would just encourage your listeners not to be discouraged if we're trying to look at these things in a little more reasonable way from what we've learned from other sources. So you want to start the Ten Commandments or wait?
I think our time's just about up. The only thing I would say is they're approaching Mount Sinai, which also has the name Mount Horeb, and it's believed to be the same mountain that Moses had at the foot of this mountain had encountered or saw the burning bush.
Okay.
And there's been quite a bit of scholarly debate over the centuries where exactly. In fact, there was one of the programs I was not watching not very long ago.
Really?
That dealt with this, actually, where was Mount Sinai. Some believe it was way over in Saudi Arabia, or what was Arabia at that time, not Saudi Arabia, or maybe on the Sinai Peninsula, which, of course, was a part of Egypt back in those days. So we'll kind of touch on some of those issues during the next session.
Okay. Well, Ron, many thanks. And to our listening audience, may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.